really fascinating was more than Catherine wanted to process right now. She offered another argument in an attempt to end it. If you thought she was a man, and you willfully engaged in unprotected sex, then pregnancy was always a risk, ipso ergo facto. It all amounts to the same thing. Catherine wasn't sure her Latin was correct, but she was nearly positive that Randy and Denise would know better.
Uh-uh, said Denise. If I fuck a dog, she don't pop out no half-dog babies.
After a moment of uncomfortable lack of response, she continued.
That was just an example. All I meant is that we ain't compatible species. I had no way of suspecting that I would leave that encounter with a child.
That's not true, said Catherine. Compatibility is a lot more lax in this world. Look at me, for instance. I'm half human and half elf. Or take the scorpion people for an even more extreme example. At some point in the past, some sick freak must have squirted his seed on a scorpion, right? Denise laughed.
Damn, girl! Your logic is stretched tighter than my cooter around a lady scorpion cock!
Catherine had been gentle so far, but she wasn't about to let this white trash would-be child rapist insult her intelligence. Here's a more logical way to think about it. If I hear you bitch about this mission again, or if you make any attempt to fuck it up or escape, I'll extract those eggs from you through your face, and I'll feed what's left of you to this giant fucking lizard. And when he shits you out, I'll feed the shit to some pigs. And when they shit, I'll... Basil's stomach rumbled like a cranking car engine that won't turn over, as if he could understand what she was saying. She was almost certain that wasn't the case, but it was excellent timing. She stroked the side of the beast's face. Poor baby's getting hungry, she looked up at Denise. Any suggestions? Denise's expression, as well as her sudden silence, suggested that she understood Catherine wasn't fucking around. That was good. Even Randy remained silent. He'd defend Denise if Catherine tried to murder her, but the fact that he didn't say as much right now meant he'd prefer Denise think he was on the fence about it, and that she'd do well to fall in line and quit her bitching. All that being the case, Basil still needed to eat. He was so big, it would be impossible to carry enough food to sustain him. Randy tested the storm drain bars until he found one that was loose. It slid straight up, as did the two to the right of it. He looked back at Catherine and Denise, then frowned at Basil.
Them's the only ones that's loose. Ain't no way Basil can squeeze through that gap.
Catherine smiled. I had a feeling this was going to be an issue. Captain Longfellow's going to shit himself when he sees Basil. She looked up at Denise. You'd better hop down, Beardy. Denise scowled at Catherine, but did as she was told. When Denise was on the ground, Catherine put her hand up high on the beast's side. Shrink! Basil let out a frightened groan, which grew higher and higher in pitch as he shrank down to half his original size, making him about 50% larger than Butterbean. Still pretty big, but just slim enough to squeeze through the immobile bars. Once they were all inside, Randy gently lowered the loose bars back to their original positions. The smell inside the city's drainage system reminded Catherine of the dumpster behind the chicken hut, though it was much fainter. This was obviously built to drain rainwater from the higher elevations of Cardinia, where the palace and several other prominent buildings were located, without flooding the rest of the city. It wasn't meant for dumping refuse, but that didn't stop people from doing just that, which would account for the filthy state of the harbor and for the present but not overpowering smell of garbage in here. And of course, where there was garbage, there were rats. With no lights inside the tunnel and only moonlight outside, it was too dark to see further than 10 feet in. But Catherine could hear their squeaks echoing off the damp brick walls, and they didn't seem very far off.
I don't like the sound of that, said Denise. Can you turn Basil back to normal size so I can ride up on his back again?
Not yet. Catherine adjusted Butterbean's collar so that the iron ring which attached to his leash was under his chin. Touching the ring, she said, Light! The tunnel lit up, and the rat squeaks rose in pitch and frequency, but the rats themselves were still beyond where she could see.
You think the light'll keep them away? Asked Randy.
I hope not. I think I just thought of a way to kill two birds with one stone.
I ain't worried about no fucking birds, said Denise. Can you think of a way to kill a bunch of goddamn rats?
Catherine looked down at her. Aren't you supposed to be a badass barbarian? Are you seriously afraid of a few rats?
Rats carry diseases. I'm afraid for my children.
That's lovely. Maybe someday you can sit them on your knee and tell them about how, between thoughts of aborting them, You use them to mask your own cowardice.
Catherine, said Randy in a motherly tone, what was you saying about killing two birds with one stone?
In other words, that's enough bickering, you two. While Basil is small like this, he should be able to get by on less food than normal, right? A couple of rats might be enough to sustain him.
Randy grinned. Why, Catherine, that's excellent thinking. I really appreciate you keeping Basil in your thoughts like that.
Catherine ruffled the fur on the back of Butterbean's neck. Go get him! Butterbean growled, barked, then darted forward. The light zoomed down the tunnel like a subway car they'd just missed. It went farther and farther down the tunnel.
Them rats is farther away than I reckoned they was, said Randy. These tunnels must really carry sound well, or...
Butterbean yelped, and it sounded about as far away as it looked. Butterbean! Cried Catherine. The light did an about-face and started heading back to them. A cacophony of normal-sounding rats grew louder and less normal-sounding. Oh, shit, said Catherine.
What?
Denise took a step back.
What is it?
Catherine reached into her bag of holding. Scythe! She pulled out the long-handled weapon and felt a little disturbed at how excited she was to be able to use it. Dire rats! Sounds like we stirred up a whole nest of them.
I don't reckon basilisk food is our biggest concern anymore right now, said Randy. Maybe you should bring Basil back up to size so he can defend himself.
That's probably a good idea. She touched Basil's back. Dispel. Basil groaned as he doubled in size, completely blocking out what little light was coming in from outside. Catherine had hoped that the sound might frighten some of the dire rats away, but their angry squeaks and squeals were so loud she could barely hear Basil at all. From what she could hear, he sounded nervous. Don't worry, big guy, she said, reaching out to soothe his fear. We'll take care of these. She felt a hairy leg where she'd been expecting leathery reptilian skin. Without even looking, she grabbed the ankle and gave it a good hard yank downward.
Fuck!
Cried Denise as she fell off Basil's back. Get your axe ready to fight! Randy drew his sword and stepped forward.
I'll hold him off as best I can. You two will have to handle what slips by me.
This tunnel's wide enough for us to fight side by side, said Catherine. I need more room to use this thing anyway. Even if this version of the scythe had been designed to be used as a weapon, it would still be more effective outside in a wheat field than it was in a cramped underground tunnel.
Good call,
Denise stepped back, careful not to back into Basil's mouth.
I'll take the rear. Let's wait until after the fight is over,
said Randy. As innocuous as that sounded, Catherine sensed there was something off about the way he'd said it. Had Randy just made a butt sex joke? She looked over at him. Randy was red in the face and trembling from trying not to giggle. This caused Catherine to giggle, which obliterated Randy's dam. As what sounded like a dozen or more giant rats approached to infect, murder, and or eat them, Catherine and Randy laughed their asses off.
Real fucking mature, guys, said Denise. You can both suck my big fat dwarf titties.
Catherine and Randy stepped aside to let Butterbean run between them. But now that he was among friends and they could all fight together, he turned around, bared his teeth, and growled. Four of the huge rats entered the sphere of light simultaneously, rushing at them. Catherine picked a target and brought the point of her scythe down hard, skewering its plump middle just to the right of its spine. It squealed in pain, its disgusting mouth opening wide, showing off its needly teeth and squirming tongue. Randy stepped up to finish it off, but two of the big rats lunged at him, biting his leg and arm and throwing him off balance. He fell backwards and managed to strike the rat on his arm with the hilt of his sword. It screamed, letting go of his arm and landing on its back between Denise and Butterbean. Catherine kicked a rat that lunged at her, sending it into a somersault that would have been comical if five more rats hadn't just entered the fray. She jerked hard on her scythe, giving the rat she'd injured a little more to remember her by. Randy grunted as he drove his sword into the rat that still had a toothy grip on his leg. Another rat jumped up at Catherine, but she'd seen it coming and anticipated how it would attack her. Just as it leaped, she crept down and thrust the shaft of her scythe underneath it, using its own inertia to catapult it up, where it bounced off the ceiling and landed behind her. Denise gave a little yelp, which was in part what Catherine was going for. Tubby little bitch needed to pull her weight. Having just used the business end of her scythe to launch that last rat, she couldn't bring the blade down on the rat that was moving in on her, the first one she'd stabbed. Instead, she did the next best thing, jabbing it hard in the muzzle with the back end of the shaft. She could feel the crunch of bone upon impact. This poor bastard, while not quite dead yet, was having a really shitty day. It made one last, desperate and feeble attempt to bite her with a mouth that barely worked anymore, and she put it out of its misery with two more jabs to the skull. Randy got back up to one knee, keeping the one rat at bay with his sword still pierced in its belly. He grabbed another one, which was running past him to bite Catherine by the tail, and yanked it back toward Denise and Butterbean.
"Yeah!" cried Denise a second later. "My knee! Motherfucker bit me in the... fuck this! I'm really angry!"
Rat shrieks from behind Catherine came to an abrupt, splattery halt. She readied her scythe to attack one of the three rats coming at her, and stopped just short of bringing it down on Denise as she charged out between Catherine and Randy. She was hardly recognizable with all of her suddenly increased muscle mass. She looked like a giant hairy meatball. Screaming like a banshee on fire, Denise tore into one rat with her axe, chopping its face in half diagonally, while grabbing another rat by the throat with her free hand. She let go of the axe and pinned the live rat on its back, throttling its throat with both hands and slamming its head repeatedly against the floor.
"Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you!"
she said as the rat writhed under her even denser than usual body. Its legs and tail flailed frantically at first, then grew more listless with each slam of the head. She was well on her way to killing it when a new rat came from behind and bit her in the ass. Denise rolled backwards onto the ass rat, pulling its tail to her mouth with both hands, and bit down hard, severing it from the body. The rat screamed, having definitely lost the ass-biting contest, and tried to run away. But Denise grabbed the tail stump and started to rotate, swinging the shrieking rat in a wide circle, spinning faster and faster. The stunned and nearly dead rat that she'd been head-slamming against the floor rolled onto its belly, but Randy made short work of it with a merciful stab to the neck. Denise spun faster and faster until she started to stumble, then released the rat, which hit the wall with a loud smack. Neither of them were done with the other. As the rat righted itself, Denise stumbled after it in a zigzag pattern. Catherine found it difficult to focus on killing the last few remaining rats because Denise's fight was so much more entertaining. When Randy drove his sword into the last rat standing, the fight was over for him and Catherine. Denise was still tenderizing her long dead rat foe's face with her fists, pummeling it again and again to the point to where its head was little more than a furry sack of pulverized brain and shards of skull.
"I think you got him,"
said Randy. Denise punched slower and slower, as if ceasing to punch something was akin to stopping a car merely by taking one's foot off the accelerator. When she was done, she hung her head and panted. Her body deflated as sweat poured down her face.
"That's fucking exhausting," she said.
Catherine remembered Tim freaking out about dire rats, but in her experience, they hadn't seemed that formidable. Of course, her experiences with them up to now had been while she was a badass vampire, and now, she supposed, she was just a general badass, at least considerably more than Tim had been when he first arrived here. She sighed. The road toward getting him back was proving to be a huge pain in the ass. Basil gobbled up the two dead rats nearest to him, and Randy was dragging a third one his way by its tail.
"Don't overfeed him," said Catherine. "We're going to be at sea for a few days, and we don't know how long it's going to be until he'll get another meal."
Randy frowned.
"But that's why I want him to eat as much as he can now while the getting's good. It'd be a shame to let all these dead rats go to waste."
"That's why we're going to keep them."
Catherine smiled at Randy and held open her bag of holding.
"It's as good as Tupperware for keeping dead bodies fresh."
"Sweet," said Randy.
He lowered the rat into the open bag and went to get another one. By the time Randy had completely cleared the floor of rats, Denise had recovered from her post-barbarian rage exhaustion and was breathing normally again. The air was thick with a metallic scent of blood, still fresh in Catherine's mind as something she'd once craved, but which now turned her stomach. It didn't help that the scents of rat shit, body odor, and garbage were mixed with it. She needed to start moving before she added the scent of
blah, blah, blah.
Denise beat her to the punch, spilling her guts into a puddle of filthy water, rat blood, and God only knew what else.
"You all right, Denise?" asked Randy.
When the last of her puke had splattered against the floor, She wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
Just my morning sickness acting up.
Randy looked down at Basil, back toward the entrance of the tunnel.
But it's the middle of the night. Damn it, Randy! They call it morning sickness, but it comes when it comes. Or fuck, who knows? Maybe I got some kind of disease when I got bit in the ass by a big-ass fucking sewer rat. I just hope my babies ain't affected. Their blood will be on your hands.
She waved her pointed finger back and forth between Randy and Catherine so that they might both be overwhelmed with guilt. Catherine gave her the finger. Chapter 19. Through a series of increasingly specific questions, Dave and Captain Righteous had gotten Murkwort to produce a way for them to be able to trust him while they all slept for the night. Everyone was exhausted, and even though Murkwort was compelled by his own magic hat to answer their questions honestly, he was as uncooperative as he could be, learning to answer questions more literally, succinctly, and in ways which were as unhelpful as possible, while still being truthful. It was a struggle to come up with a line of questioning which led them to a satisfactory solution. The solution itself, however, turned out to be simple. He had a potion he claimed would knock a dire bear out cold. When Captain Righteous finally found and opened the bottle, Dave noted that the dark green liquid inside smelled like an extremely pungent version of NyQuil. The fumes alone were almost enough to knock Dave out. Dave knew their line of questioning had yielded positive results when he, Captain Righteous, and Bingham woke up the next morning not tied to a rack or covered with leeches. Murkwort remained asleep in his chair, still bound by his stupid handkerchiefs. His head hung low as he snored.
"What's the best way to get to the Horse Head Inn from here?"
Captain Righteous looked out the window.
"The collapsed sewer district is on the opposite side of the city. Transporting a bound prisoner there on foot would attract attention. My fellow Kingsguard would ask questions I'm not sure I would know how to answer."
He sighed.
"Oh, Bingham and I have been too long away from our duties as it is."
"I agree," said Bingham.
"We should report back at once."
"Are you fucking kidding me?" cried Dave.
"What the hell am I supposed to do with him all by myself? Look at me. I'm a goddamn dwarf."
He had to hit the captain with something he actually gave a shit about.
"What about your promise to Lady Catherine?"
Captain Righteous stared pensively out the window, then turned to Dave.
"We shall escort you to your inn, but then we must report to our commanders. That is all I can do."
Dave nodded.
"That's good enough."
Now onto the problem of them being stopped on the street and questioned about transporting a man bound to a chair. Even if Captain Righteous outranked whomever was interrogating them, things could get sticky, especially considering that Murkwort hadn't actually committed any crimes. Traveling overland across the city was too risky. Too many things could go wrong. Worst-case scenarios played out in Dave's mind. Captain Righteous wasn't exactly a subtle man. If he blabbed about the dice to a superior officer, they might deem it a matter of interest to the crown and take Murkwort in for questioning themselves. Or even worse, he might be ordered to set Murkwort free.
"What about the sewers?"
asked Dave. Captain Righteous looked at him blankly.
"What about them?"
"Couldn't we travel through the sewers?"
"Have I not defiled my uniform enough for your liking?"
"Well, I thought it might be less conspicuous than trying to drag a bound old wizard through the city."
"I'm only 57, said Murkwort.
"Sorry," said Dave. "I didn't know you were awake.
Who could sleep with all of you blathering on like you do? Anyway, what kind of excuse is that? You think it acceptable to insult a man as long as it's behind his back?"
"No, I..."
Dave couldn't think of anything to say that wouldn't make him seem like less of a dick. Captain Righteous frowned.
"Are the sewers really the best idea you can think of for traveling to this Horse Head Inn?"
Dave nodded, and Murkwort said,
"Yes."
His not quite as old as Dave had thought eyes widened.
"I mean, no, I thought you were talking to me. Shit!"
"The sewers are a labyrinth," said the captain. "A group of seasoned explorers could get lost in them for weeks. Why do you think they are our best option for getting to the other side of the city?"
Murkwort fumed, but couldn't keep his lips from moving.
"Because I know how to navigate them. Arcane marks line the sewer walls, providing a clear path for anyone who knows to look for them. It's how young wizards travel in secret before they master teleportation."
Captain Righteous was about to speak, but Murkwort's lips kept moving in spite of his attempts to hold them still.
And also because I intended to call as much attention to us as possible.
He glared up at Captain Righteous.
Here I am, an innocent old man, and you assaulted me in my own home. You are a disgrace to your uniform.
You cast a spell on him before he hit you, said Bingham. An assault on a king's guard is a serious offense indeed.
That was self-defense. He was in the process of punching me in the face, and I held his arm still. He was only able to follow through because you bit me.
Bingham shuffled his feet.
That was also after you'd cast the spell.
Ha! Cried Murkwort. I'll have both your cloaks when this is through.
Dave could see something like regret or deep concern in Captain Righteous's eyes. Maybe Murkwort's threats were sinking in, or maybe he was coming to terms with how close he was getting to ending his career. This could end badly if he didn't intervene.
Captain Righteous swore an oath to protect His Majesty the King and all his subjects.
Dave was talking out of his ass, but he felt safe assuming something along the lines of what he just said was true.
Those dice you sold could, in the wrong hands, lead to devastation for this city and for the realm, maybe even the world.
Puppycock,
said Murkwort.
You know nothing of magic. You exaggerate their power. I'll happily wear that hat and repeat myself.
Murkwort scrutinized Dave.
I believe you. At least, I believe that you believe that what you say is true.
He turned his head toward Captain Righteous.
If you release me, I swear by the gods I shall not take any retaliatory actions against you. Furthermore, I shall voluntarily accompany the dwarf to be interviewed by his colleagues. In return, I expect all of my questions to be answered as well. My curiosity is piqued. I long to know more about these dice.
Captain Righteous raised his eyebrows hopefully at Dave.
What say you, dwarf?
Dave shrugged. He was apprehensive about setting a high-level wizard free after having punched him in the face, tied him to a chair, and strong-armed him for information. But he was even more apprehensive about passing up what would almost certainly be their one and only opportunity to let bygones be bygones.
He is wearing the hat!
Captain Righteous exhaled like he just jizzed himself, the expression on his face the definition of relief.
Chapter 20.
The forest was eerily quiet, as if a silence spell had been cast on it. No frogs croaked, no bees buzzed, not a single chirp from bird or cricket. Every acorn that dropped sounded like a hammer in an empty church.
Is it always this quiet?
Asked Cooper, as he, Chaz, and Zippy Pants McGoatcock, or whatever the fuck his name was, stood among the outermost trees looking deeper in. It didn't smell as earthy as a forest should. Aside from his own contributions, it smelled unsettlingly sterile.
The Dark Ones have destroyed or driven out all animal life, from wild boar to the lowliest insect. The centaurs, unicorns, and elven druids have all fled to seek new woodlands to call their homes. Even most of the satyrs have gone. Only the bravest, stubbornest, and stupidest remain.
Cooper snorted.
Which one are you?
I suppose that remains to be determined.
Who are the Dark Ones?
Asked Chaz.
Not who, but what? For their souls have departed.
So they're zombies?
Ha!
The satyr took a swig from one of his wineskins. Cooper had assumed it was water, but a trace of the dark liquid ran down his billy goat beard, identifying it as the same wild blackberry wine he'd shared with them the previous night. It was some good shit, to be sure, but not something Cooper would drink at dawn. Dude was hardcore.
The day I witness a centaur fleeing a zombie is the day I put away my pipes for good. The Dark Ones have no bodies either.
And what the fuck is left of them?
Asked Cooper.
Anguish, contempt, and an utter hatred for all life manifested as shadow.
Zazzy Frazzle's head jerked to the left as he pointed at something in the trees.
There!
Cooper squinted in the direction he was pointing, but couldn't make out anything unusual.
Well, what are you pointing at? I don't see anything.
They're difficult to spot unless they're moving or standing in light. It's too early to enter the wood. The shadows are too thick, allowing the Dark Ones to move about freely and nearly invisible.
Chaz kept his eyes in the direction the satyr had pointed as he knelt down to pick up an acorn. When he stood back up, he said,
Zanzifurl, let me borrow your pipes.
The satyr laughed nervously, but didn't look away from where he'd claimed to see an evil dark spirit.
The magic of a satyr's pipes can only be produced by satyrs, and the dark ones haven't a mind to be affected by it.
I'm a bard, said Chaz. I produce magic through music. The instrument doesn't need to be magical.
Suit yourself.
The satyr held out his pipes to Chaz.
Perhaps a song will sate its thirst for living souls.
You don't need to be a bitch about it.
Chaz took the pipes and blew a few quavering notes.
Jesus, dude,
said Cooper.
You're even shit for a bard.
I'm getting a feel for the instrument. I've never played one of these before.
A few notes later, it started to sound more like music, familiar music.
I see the light.
He stopped singing as the acorn began to glow in Chaz's hand, and before Cooper could recall exactly what song he'd been playing, the trees around them glowed brightly as the enchanted acorn banished the shadows.
Jesus fucking Christ,
said Chaz, dropping the acorn and pipes and drawing his rapier. One shadow remained, a vaguely human-shaped, faceless absence of light ducked behind one of the thicker trees it had been standing next to. Gaunt, almost to the point of skeletal, it raised its hands so that they melded with its head where its eyes should be. A somehow even darker void opened up like a mouth as it let out a silent scream. Throwing down its fists, it slipped right through the trunk of the tree like it didn't exist and flew straight at Chaz. Chaz sliced through it with his rapier, which had about as much stopping power as the tree had. The shadowy creature latched onto Chaz's face with its gaping mouth and gripped the back of its head with both hands. Chaz screamed, dropping to his knees and ineffectually swatting at it.
Fuck,
said Cooper. He looked back at the satyr, who had hopped back a good 10 feet.
What do we?
Feed me.
Of course. A powerful enough magical weapon could strike an incorporeal creature. Cooper hoped Nabi was up to the task. He took her off his back and swung at the shadowy creature sucking on Chaz's face. The axe appeared to swing through the creature, but Cooper didn't feel any resistance at all. He'd expected to feel something, even if it was just a patch of slightly denser air. Maybe whatever magical bonus Nabi was packing wasn't enough to affect this type of creature. He scrambled to think of another way to save Chaz. Would pissing on it do anything? But the shadow monster let go of Chaz's face and whirled toward Cooper.
Finish it!
Cooper supposed he was mistaken. Apparently, Nabi had gotten a piece of this face-sucking, shadowy asshole after all. The creature launched itself at him, arms outstretched and mouth open wide. Having no time to swing, Cooper rolled out of its way, hopped back up to his feet, and brought Nabi down on it from behind. Again, he felt nothing as the axe passed through it, resistance only coming when the blade chopped deep into the earth. It came at him again before he was able to wrench Nabi from the ground. He dodged its attack, but instinctively swung a fist at it. While there was no physical resistance, he felt an icy chill in his arms as it passed through the creature's shadowy genital area.
One more hit.
The shadow monster flew for Chaz again, who was on his hands and knees over a puddle of his own vomit. Hardly able to move, he made for a sure thing than Cooper.
No!
Chaz groaned as the creature mimicked his pose, hiding itself by sharing the same space he was occupying. Chaz shivered, then began to convulse, and the shadow monster did its best to mimic his motions.
You cowardly motherfucker!
Fuck you,
said Chaz, trembling violently on his hands and knees.
Not you, dumbass.
Cooper could see what game the shadow monster was playing. In order to strike it with Nabi, he'd have to chop through Chaz as well.
If that's how you want to play it.
He held Nabi over his head.
What are you doing?
Cried Chaz.
Nice try, shithead,
said Cooper. He kicked Chaz hard in the ribs, knocking him a good 5 feet away and leaving the shadow creature exposed. He brought Nabi down hard, and the creature exploded into a bunch of tiny fragments of shadow which quickly evaporated into the light.
Are you okay?
Cooper asked Chaz.
Asshole,
Chaz groaned.
My fucking ribs.
Sorry, dude. I didn't have a choice.
I know. It just hurts a lot. Calling you an asshole alleviates the pain a little. Thank you for that.
Cooper snorted.
You're welcome.
Chaz got up on his hands and knees, then struggled to stand upright.
Did I put on weight? I feel like my bones are made out of lead.
You're not heavier, said the satyr. You're weaker. The dark ones drain your strength when they attack you.
Well, shit. That was already one of my lowest scores.
I'm afraid I do not understand your meaning.
I wasn't a strong person to begin with.
Ziggy Faggles nodded.
In time, your strength will return, provided you avoid further attacks.
What happens if I get attacked again?
Asked Chaz.
If they drain you of your strength entirely, you become as they are. Too many of my brethren have turned to shadow, living beyond death in constant anguish.
You're kind of bumming me out, man. I get the whole white privilege thing,
said Cooper. He held Nabi up to look at her.
So where do we go from here?
You must travel deeper into the forest. My pixies will find you.
What did she say?
Asked Chaz. Cooper frowned.
Nothing too specific. We just gotta keep going deeper into the forest until we get picked up by pixies.
That's not a plan. We're gonna die and turn into dark ones.
If that's your biggest fear, you might consider that you're part of the problem.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Chaz bent over and picked up his acorn.
Jesus, it feels like a fishing sinker.
We no longer need it, said the satyr. The rising sun will keep most of the dark ones at bay and make the hungrier ones easier to spot and avoid.
That sort of cravenness is why the forest is overrun with them. We must hunt down and destroy them all.
Cooper didn't want to call this guy a cowardly bitch while he was guiding them through the forest, but he felt he should say something about his axe's intentions.
I don't think Nabi intends to do much avoiding.
We should hurry if we're to penetrate as deeply into the wood as possible before mid-afternoon.
What happens at mid-afternoon?
Asked Chaz.
Half the daylight hours will have been spent. If we've found no safe haven, we'll have to turn around. We don't want to be in this wood after dark.
Chaz nodded.
That makes sense.
He threw the acorn with what looked like more effort than should be necessary. It landed about 8 feet ahead of him.
Damn it.
That's amazing,
said Cooper.
It takes a certain degree of innovation to make you suck more than you already did.
Chaz looked like he wanted to give Cooper the finger, but couldn't be bothered with the effort of lifting his hand. Chapter 21. Julian lay on his back, gazing up at the sky and willing himself to not think about Ravenous. Cooper may pretend not to like him, but Julian could tell that they'd bonded during their time together at sea, and he knew that Cooper would do everything in his power to look after Ravenous. So he focused instead on a spider busily building a web between two tree branches. It had already finished laying its anchor strands and was about a third of the way through laying the connecting sticky strands spiraling out from the center. He remembered having seen a documentary about spiders in which he learned that the spider is able to produce both sticky and non-sticky strands with which to build their webs. If human beings had evolved to be able to produce adhesive fibers from their asses, how might modern society look different? Would slavery have been abolished earlier if there was no demand for cotton, since every person on Earth would shit out as much silk as they could ever want? Would there have even been a slave trade at all? Would obesity be an issue? Or would people be able to convert as much food into silk as they wanted, thus self-regulating their caloric output? Given that spider silk is 5 times stronger than steel, and a person is so much larger than a spider, would human-produced strands be so much thicker and subsequently stronger? Would all clothing and building materials be bulletproof? What would that mean for the gun industry? Maybe there wouldn't even be one, because humans would have just been super chill, swinging from tree branches together by their asses, and not have felt the need to build weapons with which to slaughter each other.
What are you thinking about? Asked Stacy.
Ravenous?
It was easier that way.
We should really try to find Dave and Captain What's-His-Name.
They got up, got their things together, and started the short walk back toward the noise.
I spent a lot of time thinking about what you said last night, said Julian. And while I don't like it, I think you're right. We should keep quiet about the dice until we have them all. We've captured all the remaining Mordred avatars, or we find out that Mordred's gotten his hands on one of them.
Good.
I was just thinking that if something bad were to happen as a result of us keeping our secret, I wouldn't want that to be on my hands.
I understand.
But now I'm thinking that if something bad were to happen as a result of too many people knowing about the dice,
which seems way more likely now that I've given it some thought. I don't want that on my hands either.
You don't have to explain yourself to me, said Stacy. It was my idea, remember?
I know. I'm rationalizing it to myself.
Don't overthink it. You're making the decision that's statistically the most probable to be the best for everyone.
It only took a few minutes to walk back to the outermost dive bars and rent-by-the-hour hotels farthest away from the main party strip. It smelled like Cooper's apartment back on Earth. Younger people sat on the front steps of buildings next to piles of puke, cradling their heads after a night of going at it harder than they should have. Tourists who dreamed of the day when they could finally party with the big boys. The gods only knew how much money they'd spent to have this experience, and they'd likely be going home with barely any memory of it.
"Do you think they spent the night in one of these places?" asked Julian.
"Who knows? I'm kind of surprised they didn't turn up in the woods. Free is free, and I think I prefer to sleep on the ground than on any bed I've seen so far in this world."
Stacy glanced left and right, down alleys and side streets, as they headed toward the main thoroughfare.
"Don't focus too hard on them. They're easy enough to spot, as are we. This is a small island, and we're bound to bump into each other eventually. Focus more on spotting another die."
"What about Mordred?"
Stacy shrugged.
"We only know what one of them looks like. If we see him, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. The die should be much easier to spot, both for us and for Mordred, which makes finding them all the more urgent."
"What makes you think they'll be so easy to spot?" asked Julian. "They're tiny and valuable. They might be locked away in safes somewhere."
"They're insanely magical, so much so that none of these wizards knows what to do with them. The only thing they're good for is showing off. That's why the one we've got is mounted on a pendant."
Reaching the main street, they found a few older wizards staggering from bar to bar, some alone and others stumbling in groups of two or three, singing and holding each other up. Julian watched one old wizard trip over the threshold as he exited a bar, bend over a railing, vomit out about 8 drinks, stand upright again, shake it off, then head back into the bar.
"I don't expect we'll find anything at this time of morning."
"Maybe not," said Stacy. "But if we do, they should be a lot easier to subdue. Let's start hitting up bars and see what we can learn."
"Of course, that always proves educational."
Julian peered up and down the street. No one place stood out as somewhere a dice-adorned wizard might like to spend his time.
"Where should we start?"
Stacy frowned up at the live nude gnome sign.
"Let's start at one side of the street and work our way to the other."
"Nothing quite like a proper pub crawl at dawn."
"That's the spirit. Now what do you think, right or left?"
After having a look each way, Julian decided that right seemed like the shortest walk. The last bar they found was called the Lucky Cauldron. The sign included a silhouetted picture of a cauldron with a pair of women's legs sticking out of it.
"What is that supposed to suggest?"
asked Julian.
"It's like you're trying to sell being boiled alive as sexy."
Stacy shrugged.
"Maybe it's a wizard kink. Let's check it out."
When they entered, Julian breathed in the heady aroma of jasmine incense. A young, half-elven woman in a form-fitting black dress looked up at them with tired eyes from behind a sleek, polished, dark cherry bar.
"Good morning," she said.
Her tone was polite, but seemed to want to highlight the morning part of it.
"What can I get for you?"
It only now occurred to Julian that all the floating drink trays were gone. Maybe that was a happy hour thing or something.
"We're not actually here to drink," said Stacy. "We're looking for information."
"Did the sign outside suggest that this is a library?"
Julian frowned.
"To be honest, I wasn't sure what the sign was supposed to be suggesting. It was kind of ambiguous. I was actually just mentioning..."
"This is a pub. I deal in drinks. If you don't want a drink, I suggest you go somewhere else. Is that unambiguous enough for you?"
"3 shots of whatever you recommend, please,"
said Julian, jumping in before Stacy had a chance to even further lower the ambiguity bar with her feelings over being talked to like that.
"You sound like you could use a drink."
"Sorry, it's been a rough night."
The bartender produced a large glass bottle and 3 shot glasses from under the bar. The bottle wasn't labeled, and the liquid inside was dark yellow, like unhealthy urine, or honey. Yes, honey was a good comparison. Why had his mind gone to unhealthy urine first?
"You wouldn't believe what some of these rich wizards think that paying for a shot of liquor entitles them to."
"I'd believe it," said Stacy, raising her glass once the bartender finished pouring the drinks. I waited tables in college. She, Julian, and the bartender clinked glasses and necked back their drinks. It might have been good liquor, but Julian was no aficionado. All he could say about it was that it burned his throat, and it was a hell of a thing to take down before breakfast.
Not bad, eh? Said the bartender.
Yeah,
Julian croaked.
Smooth.
Ah, said Stacy, putting her glass back down hard on the bar. That's the stuff.
Before Julian got his voice back to object, the bartender was pouring another round.
And don't even get me started on the young tourists. They come in here, order the cheapest stone piss in the place, and act like I'm some kind of damsel that they're gonna drag away from this sad life. And you know how insulting that is. I own this place. I'll probably make a better living here than most of those idiots ever will. I mean, honestly, do you know how much real estate on the Crescent Shadow goes for?
No, said Stacy. How much?
A lot. And I worked my ass off to save up enough money to pay for it. This was a dream I'd had for a long time, and I made it come true. And most days it's great. But then there are some days I wonder why I ever bothered.
She and Stacy took their shots. Then Stacy looked at Julian, then down at his lonely full shot glass.
May I ask a question now? Asked Julian.
The bartender said nothing, but continued to stare at him. Stacy, also silent, nodded down to his drink. Julian sighed.
Ugh, fine.
He gulped back the shot and put down the glass. This was not going to be an efficient way of gathering information.
How about now?
The bartender flashed him a friendly smile.
What knowledge may I bestow upon you?
She refilled the glasses. Julian took a quick glance to reassure himself that the place was empty, then leaned over the bar to murmur.
We're looking for some men.
Go down the alley beside Live New Gnomes and take the stairs to the second floor,
Stacy snort laughed.
I probably could have opened more clearly, said Julian. I'm not used to drinking hard liquor this early in the morning. We're looking for some specific men for personal, non-sexual reasons.
Do these men have names?
Probably,
the bartender frowned.
What do they look like?
I don't know.
You're not giving me a lot to work with.
One of them is a halfling wearing red robes. Then again, he might have changed them by now.
What about men wearing dice? Asked Stacy. Wearing dice?
The bartender shrugged.
I'm not even sure what that means.
Stacy picked up her glass.
You'd know it if you saw it. Cheers.
Chapter 22. A half moon peeked through a gap in the swiftly moving clouds. Glints of its reflection, far out to sea, made the water look much calmer than it sounded, sloshing against the hulls of rocking and creaking ships here in the harbor. In all his years living on the Gulf Coast, Randy had never been on a boat. Like most things, the sea intimidated him. He found it strange that he felt no such feelings of intimidation now, even as they were about to board a much more primitive vessel than anything he would have been likely to board back home. The rickety old boat looked to have been patched together from the remains of shipwrecks.
"He's a bigger bastard than I thought,"
said Captain Longfellow, when Randy, Catherine, and Denise herded Basil nervously along the pier. They were escorted by two of the captain's most trusted crewmen, quiet men who had only spoken to issue one-word instructions on the way from the storm drain to the ship. Neither of them so much as flinched or showed the slightest trace of disgust, no matter how hard Denise came onto them.
"We're gonna need more planks!"
Randy doubtfully eyed the single plank serving as a bridge between the pier and the ship's deck. If Basil fell in the water, he was a goner for sure. There wouldn't be any way to pull him out before he drowned. Randy wasn't sure that another couple of planks were going to be enough.
"Are you sure we can get him across?"
"Hey, fear not, lad. I once boarded a dire bear on here, just because another captain said it couldn't be done."
Captain Longfellow frowned.
"Whether or not it was worth the damage he done to me ship, be a matter of one's opinion."
The captain's men hauled out three more planks before another problem occurred to Randy.
"I'm sorry," he called out.
"Mr. Captain, sir."
"Aye?"
"Basil's legs are aligned in two rows. I don't see how he's going to be able to distribute his weight between more than two planks at any one time." "Walk him sideways, ye jism-gurgling imbecile."
"You let him talk to you like that?"
asked Denise.
Randy shrugged.
He talks like that to everyone, so I'm told.
He looked back up at the captain.
He ain't trained to do that. He won't understand.
He'll understand a ramrod up the arse.
Randy couldn't see how that was helpful or even made any sense at all.
Ain't you got a harness and crane or...
I know what to do, said Catherine. Keep him calm and don't let him eat me.
Randy stroked Basil's cheek.
Of course. You could make him small again. Why didn't we think of that in the first place?
That's a second-level spell. I only get one of those per day. I've got a better idea.
What is it?
We'll get him to walk sideways.
Hey, you twat-munching tree whore,
said Captain Longfellow.
What the fuck did you just call me?
I told you, said Randy. He talks like that to everyone.
Don't be taking credit for my ideas when you mean to board me ship.
My idea is a practical means to implement your idea, you peg-dicked monkey fucker.
The crew all stopped what they were doing, making the night dead silent. Some of them stared at Catherine, while others stared at the captain. Captain Longfellow peered at Catherine through narrowed eyes. Finally, he pointed at her dramatically.
That one!
He shouted.
Rides at no charge!
The crew roared with laughter and returned to their various tasks. Catherine placed her palm flat on top of Basil's snout.
Speak! Basil groaned.
That's very impressive, said Randy. And while it's a step in the right direction, I don't think...
Please shut up, said Catherine.
She stroked the side of Basil's snout as he groaned again.
Oh no, not you.
They went back and forth, Catherine talking and Basil groaning. It started out innocuous enough, like how one might talk to an animal even though they knew it couldn't understand them. But Randy paid closer attention when Catherine started talking more specific, like she was responding to concerns that the basilisk was having.
I know, Catherine said sympathetically. It must be very confusing for you, but the people who did that to you are dead. You killed them. His name is Randy, and he's sworn to look after you. He's a good person. No, I'm his friend. Nothing's wrong with him. No, he's handsome enough, if that's your type.
Catherine scoffed.
No, I'm most certainly not. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But he is... Yes.
Basil turned his head slightly back toward Randy, then started jiggling as a strange wheezing sound came from deep in his throat, like he was coughing, or... Randy scowled at Catherine.
Is he laughing?
Catherine shrugged.
Give him a break. He's had a rough time lately. Let him have this.
Can we get him up on the boat, please?
Good idea.
Catherine focused back on Basil.
Do you think you could walk sideways for me? We need to get you on the boat. It's, a thing made out of wood, which we use to carry us over water.
Catherine sighed.
Jesus Christ. No, sorry, it's not you. I wasn't expecting to have to. It's a material we get from cutting down trees. But because you're really heavy, and we need to walk you across four wooden planks, which could break if your weight isn't distributed evenly across all of them, then you'd fall into the water and drown. That's when you're so engulfed in water that you can't breathe air and you die. Yeah. I guess that would seem pretty amazing if you spent all your life in a desert. Oh, shit.
Basil groaned louder.
What's wrong?
Said Randy.
The spell timed out.
Can you cast it again?
I've got one more, but I kind of wanted to save it for Butterbean. Let's see if he'll walk sideways for us now.
Randy and Catherine guided Basil forward, lining him up directly in front of the planks. They each took a small step onto the plank behind them and tugged on Basil's scaly hide.
Come on, big guy, said Randy. You can do it, one step at a time.
Come on, Basil, said Catherine. I'm right here with you.
Basil's left foot stepped out sideways, touching down next to Catherine's foot. One at a time, from front to rear, his other 3 feet followed. The planks bent further than the one Randy had used to board the ship the first time, and he was almost certain they were going to snap. Hold these planks together, Jesus. He felt strange to have such a certainty that his prayer would actually be received. Then he felt guilty for his lack of certainty that his prayers back home had ever been received. Basil let out a groan which needed no translation. He was scared. Not being able to see was bad enough, but at least he could always rely on the ground being there. The instability of the planks, combined with Catherine's introduction to the concept of drowning, had the poor creature terrified. Randy laid his palm flat on Basil's skin.
Take it easy. Ain't nothing to worry about. You're doing fine.
Randy believed it, and it was true. Basil stopped groaning. He also believed the truth of Randy's word. Before he knew it, Randy was safely aboard the Maiden's Voyage with Catherine and Basil. When Basil stepped aboard, the whole boat leaned toward the pier, causing two of the planks to fall in the water.
Shit!
Screamed Catherine as she lost her footing and pitched toward the open water. Captain Longfellow grabbed a rope with one hand and caught Catherine with the other.
Never been aboard a ship before, have ye?
He said, pulling her in close. Randy guided Basil to the middle of the deck, and the ship leveled out. Catherine pushed herself free from the captain's grip.
A little swim wouldn't have killed me.
She gave the air a little sniff.
You could do with a wash yourself.
Captain Longfellow grinned, showing off teeth made of a variety of precious metals. He walked around Basil's front side, keeping a safe distance.
That's a fine beast you got there,
he turned to Randy.
I suppose it goes without saying that you'll be responsible for cleaning his shit.
Randy nodded.
Yes, sir, I understand.
And there will be no visitation without you being escorted by either myself or Alexei. If the passengers get wind of this, they'll panic. And the sea is no place for a panic, you hear?
Yes, sir. Of course, sir.
Bring it this way,
said the captain, sure-footed on the gently rocking ship as he proceeded to the rearmost part of the deck. He raised his left hand and twirled his fingers around.
Aye!
Shouted one of the crewmen as he started turning a winch near the rear railing. A series of ropes and pulleys came to life, and a large section of the deck revealed itself as a ramp leading down into the interior of the ship. Captain Longfellow led the way down into the dark cargo hold. It was stark and strictly utilitarian, with no lights, windows, or any kind of adornments visible in the dim moonlight. When Randy followed, leading Basil, it seemed to occur to the captain how much room Basil was going to take up. He scooted back up the ramp, his back pressed flat against the wall as he and Basil passed each other, only daring to exhale when he was halfway back up the ramp.
I don't see much in the way of luggage between ye. Please tell me you've got something to feed that thing, aside from me crew and passengers.
We've got it covered, said Catherine.
Basil groaned as Randy walked back up the ramp without him. Randy felt bad about leaving him down there in the dark, then felt worse remembering that Basil was already constantly in the dark. Perhaps that should have made Randy feel better, considering that the darkness itself wouldn't contribute to the misery Basil would suffer over the next couple of days, but it didn't.
Can I give him one now? Randy asked Catherine. So he's got something to nibble on while he gets accustomed to his new environment.
Sure.
Catherine held open the bag of holding.
You can go ahead and do the honors.
Randy reached in.
Big rat!
He shuddered as he felt the tail in his hand, bony and loose-skinned. But he supposed that, while blindly grabbing a giant dead rat, the tail was the best part he could have hoped for. He pulled out the rat corpse, bracing himself for the foul stench of decomposition, but was pleasantly surprised that the foul stench seemed to be just refuse and rat shit. Catherine must have been right about that bag keeping things fresh. Someday, it might be nice to get one of those bags, but a new one which hadn't had any dead bodies or vomit or anything, and keep a bunch of bread and cold cuts in it.
That'd be a nice bag,
said Captain Longfellow, not even attempting to conceal the covetous look in his eyes. Catherine narrowed her eyes at him.
You keep your hands to yourself, or I'll show you the inside.
Randy tossed the dead rat down the ramp and felt tears welling up in his eyes.
Close it before I change my mind.
Captain Longfellow put a hand on Randy's shoulder.
He'll be fine, lad. It may be a bit more cramped than what he's used to, but not so much so as the room ye three'll be staying in.
What?
Said Catherine.
I have to share room with him?
She looked at Denise.
And that?
Aye,
said the captain.
And whoever shows up to fill the fourth bunk in the room?
He led them to the cabins, which were stacked on top of each other like cake tiers, each a little smaller than the one below it, creating a one-foot-wide ledge to navigate sideways on each tier. Captain Longfellow opened the door of the nearest deck-level cabin. The inside looked like the bathroom of an abandoned gas station, but with cots instead of plumbing, and the graffiti all written in knife marks or blood.
The ones down here are slightly larger than the ones above, but the higher you climb, the more privacy you have. What with fewer folks climbing past your rooms to go shit-chum the waters?
He hadn't been kidding when he compared Basil's accommodations to their own.
Randy felt a lot less guilty now for making Basil stay in the cargo hold. On either side of an already thinner-than-usual doorway, there were two bunks, the upper bunks only about 3 feet above the lower bunks, and the ceiling about 2.5 feet above the upper bunks. It seemed less like a cabin and more like a filing cabinet drawer.
"This is for 4 people?" said Catherine.
"Hey! And don't forget this little feller!"
Captain Longfellow bent over to pet Butterbean, but straightened and raised his hand innocently when the wolf growled at him. Catherine leaned into the tiny cabin, then immediately pulled back.
"Oh, it smells like fish and B.O. in there."
"Perhaps ye be misinformed about what this ship's purpose be. The maiden's voyage is not a luxury barge destined for the isles of carnal pleasures."
"Is that a real place?"
asked Denise.
"This is a transport ship for those desperate or foolhardy enough to seek their fortunes on Baran, and for those who've come to realize their mistake and seek passage back. If you're unhappy with the accommodations, I wish you luck finding more comfortable passage for yourselves in a god's damned basilisk."
"I'm sorry," said Catherine. "I didn't mean to."
"And I suppose I should get this out of the way now. Aboard me ship, you'll be expected to fish for your supper. I provide the rods, lines, and hooks, but the aches in your bellies will be soothed only by what the sea be willing to provide."
"I ain't complaining or nothing," said Randy. "I'm just curious is all. You said it's a big priority to keep folks as calm and docile aboard your ship as possible, right?"
"Aye."
"Well, don't the scarcity of food contribute to panic?"
Captain Longfellow nodded.
"I used to think the same until I had a particularly rowdy crowd on a particularly long voyage. They was fighting for the sake of fighting, and it only got worse as the voyage went on. 'Twas all me crew could do to keep them from killing one another."
His eyes glazed over with the unpleasant memory.
"And then the storm came. The winds threw us off course, costing us 2 more weeks before we'd reached our destination."
"And you didn't have enough food?"
"We had plenty of food. A good sailor expects the unexpected. Storms in the South Sea are not uncommon during the summer months. But 2 of the passengers had planned their trip so they'd reach Baran before the full moon. Suffice it to say, that didn't happen."
He widened his eyes at Randy, seemingly for dramatic effect.
"And so their curse was revealed."
Randy gasped.
"Were they..."
He didn't know why, but he felt he should whisper.
"Werewolves?" "Pish, no, thank the gods. What a mess that would have been. They were rare rats, just as vile, but not quite so violent. We found them in the morning, bare-ass naked in the food stores, in their hybrid forms, and fast asleep. They'd shat all over the place. Every last bit of food was contaminated."
"What did they have to say for themselves when you woke them up?" asked Catherine.
"Har! Not much, lass. They were swinging by the necks from the yards within an hour. Couldn't even use them for chum. No one wants to risk eating a fish that's possibly been contaminated with lycanthropy."
"I guess that's when you started fishing," said Randy.
"Aye, and you never seen folks get along so well as when they don't know whose line will pull in the next fish."
Chapter 23 Chaz woke up groggy and confused. What was that continuous rushing sound and those grunting noises? Why did he feel like he was moving? Why was he unable to move? He opened his eyes. Tree branches rushed upward against a background of pink evening sky. He was on his back, being dragged along the forest floor. Lifting his head, which felt as heavy as a bowling ball, he found that he was bound with twine, like Gulliver. His arms were wrapped firmly to his sides, and his legs were tied together. Lifting his head a bit more, he saw that his feet were also tied to the braided leather harnesses of 2 black boar, which were pulling him on some kind of sled. He looked back and saw that Cooper and Zanzifurl were likewise tied to bamboo sleds and being dragged through the forest by boar. The boar seemed very purposeful in their task, like they knew exactly where they were going, despite having no one to guide them. Unable to fathom what purpose a boar might have for abducting them, or the means by which a boar, even an unusually intelligent one, would be able to manipulate string with their hooves well enough to tie them to sleds, Chaz suspected the boar weren't working alone.
"Hello?"
he called out.
"Hey, is anybody there?
What are you...
He felt something like two fingers poking him in the belly. Two indentations in his shirt matched the feeling, but he couldn't see whatever was making the indentation.